A very warm welcome to the World of Lord Russell podcast talk show. And today's show is the Goal Gourmet, which captures the life of an English performer professional football player who played in the Football League in the 1970s and 80s as a forward goal machine. He began his career at Doncaster Rovers after being spotted by manager Laurie McMenemy, and he went on to spend 7 years there as a first team player. He went on to attract attention from higher divisions for several years, including spending time on trial at Bobby Robson's famous Ipswich Town at the time, of course, great site they were then, before signing for Leyton Orient in the summer of 1977. Ever present in his first year at Orient, he finished as the club's top scorer with 21 goals, as well as scoring 7 times in the FA Cup as Orient reached the semi-finals, beating Chelsea and Middlesbrough along the way. We're just going to talk about that Chelsea match, Peter, I can tell you that now. So yes, folks, it gives me immense pleasure to welcome on the show Peter Kitchen. Welcome to the show, Peter.
Thank you, Russell. Pleasure to be here.
Actually, the pleasure's all mine. It really is great to have you on the show. You've got such a rich history, really, playing football. And we will get onto that Chelsea match, I can assure you. Peter, it's always good to start at the beginning. You were born in Mexborough, West Riding of Yorkshire, where you attended Mexborough Grammar School and represented Yorkshire senior schools and England B teams. In fact, looked this up actually, Mexborough is where a number of sports stars originate from, including Dennis Priestley, the 2-time world darts champion, who was on the show just a couple of weeks ago. Must be sank in the water, Peter, in Mexborough, I think, because quite a few stars come from there. However, you began your career at Doncaster Rovers, and after being spotted by Laurie McMenemy, how did all this come about, Peter?
Well, I mean, I never really envisaged ever being a footballer at all. I mean, as a youngster, you know, yes, talking about 6 or 7 years old, I was a bit of an infant prodigy at football, because I'd been playing with my brother, who was 4 years older than me, and his mates. So I was pretty good at dribbling. And really, you know, we used to play with the old jumpers for goalposts, etc. And, you know, I naturally just seemed to become pretty good. And I went to junior school, and at 7 years old, I was selected for the under-11s team and ended up being captain for 2 or 3 years at junior school level, and played for the district team. And then I sort of lost a little bit of interest in football as I got into my teens. And like most teenage boys, I was more interested in sampling Yorkshire bitter and cider and you know, trying to chat girls up, finding girlfriends, etc. You know,
exactly. Normal male, a normal young lad.
Sexual. Anyway, you know, my dad, I got to 15, 16. I'd done my O levels at school, got 6 O levels, 5 CSE grade ones, didn't know what to do. My dad, who was a coal miner, spent 40 odd years down the mines, and had 2 or 3 years off to go and fight the Japanese in Burma.
Oh, wow. Well,
that's what he says it was. But he was actually very brave. He was a Chindit, working behind enemy lines. And it's only now I can realize how brave he was.
It's a story there itself, isn't it, Peter?
Yeah. Heavens. And then in his broad Yorkshire accent, he said to me, "They're not going out, Pitsy. They that can get this and stay on at school and get this and a good education. They're a bright lad, you know. You got all these old levels. Get the A levels." Didn't know anything about what the A levels and O levels were about, really, but just thought that was the thing you had to do. So I went up to the grammar school. Within a couple of weeks, I was playing football the sports master, a very, very a wonderful sports teacher, Bob Bennett, he asked me if I fancied a game in the second 11. So I played a game, scored a hat-trick. Following week, he asked me to play in the first 11. And from there, I sort of made the jump, really, from playing in the first 11 to playing for Yorkshire grammar schools. And I had a couple of years playing for Yorkshire Grammar Schools, and I actually played for England Grammar School B team. I didn't get in the first England squad, but I made the B squad. We were we were on a school's football tournament in Skegness, and I played for the England B team, scored two goals against Derby County Youth. And there were several scouts there, Doncaster's scout there, and he recommended me to Laurie McMenemy, who contacted me, asked me if I'd like to join Doncaster Rovers youth team. I said, well, yeah, I will, but I'm doing my A levels at the moment, and I'm not going to leave school till I'm 18. And then he asked me if I'd like to go on a coaching course to Lillisham.
Wow.
What this coaching course was, there were about 50 to 70 coaches.
Absolutely right. So that's a fabulous story. I mean, just missing out on Leeds United by literally, a few moments, really, after signing for Doncaster Rovers. I mean, that's an incredible story in itself, Peter, isn't it, really? Fantastic. But you did make your Doncaster Rovers debut at the age of 18 and scored after just 2 minutes, in fact, during a 3-0 win over Shrewsbury Town. And you scored again in your second game, this time the 2-1 defeat to Swansea City. So you could say you made an immediate impact and destined to become a crowd favourite, really. Incredible.
Yeah. I mean, Doncaster, two seasons before, they'd won the old Fourth Division Championship.
Mm.
And that's it. The season that I was playing, they were struggling. And they hadn't signed any players from getting promotion. And as normally, when you don't, you don't build on the success and the momentum you've made, you start to struggle and players were getting older. And so we were struggling near the bottom. We hadn't won away from home, and I'd scored a few goals in the reserves. And he said, Laurie McMenemy said to me, I'm going to give you your debut tonight. So we went to Shrewsbury, and I couldn't believe it. Somebody knocked the ball through.
Yeah.
And instinctively, I just volleyed it, and it rocketed in, And we ended up winning the game 3-0. And then the following week at home, we played Swansea City. And another time I was knocked through, and I managed to drop my shoulder, beat the player and the keeper, and rolled it into the net. And Laurie McMenemy started saying to me, if you don't score within the first half, I'm going to bring you off.
Brilliant.
And I had quite a good season. I wasn't picked every week, in and out. I ended up playing about 13, 14 games from November, when I made my debut, to the end of the season, and scored about six goals. So it was quite a decent return for my first season.
Definitely.
However, the downside of it was that because the team was struggling and we got relegated, Laurie McMenemy got the sack.
Oh.
And we got a new manager in, and I was dropped back down the list, and I lost a couple of seasons, really.
Mm.
Which looking back now, I realize those sort of things really affect your development.
Definitely.
You need to be, when you're a young player, you need to be playing with better players and playing regularly, and that's how you progress more.
Absolutely right. I couldn't agree more. And whilst at Doncaster Rovers as well, you played alongside a chap called Mike Elwes, forming a formidable strike partnership, actually. And in one of the biggest games in Doncaster Rovers' history at the time, when Doncaster Rovers drew 2-2 with Liverpool in the FA Cup at Anfield, I think in January 1974, with yourself, Peter, scoring one of those goals. And before losing 2-0 in the replay, I mean, what a match at Anfield. Please tell us more about that. To score at Anfield, it's a fantastic experience, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, when we were drawn against Liverpool at Anfield, I don't think anybody, could really believe it. Because, I mean, to get to the third round for a fourth division side is not easy anyway. But to then draw Liverpool, who were top of the first division, and we were actually bottom of the old fourth division, what's now League Two.
Mm.
And no one expected us to to do anything. We had a lot of good young players, but we were, you know, we were a fairly raw side. We were all learning our trade. And myself and Mike, I actually played wide on the left that game. And Mike was playing down the centre with a guy called Brendan O'Callaghan, who eventually him and I became the front partnership and did very well together. And Kevin Keegan opened the scoring within about 15 minutes. And we thought, well, that's it. You know, expected to cave in. But 5 minutes later, I think I equalized. And then just before halftime, Brendan scored a goal to put us 2-1 up. And I have to say that at halftime, the Liverpool fans gave us a standing ovation.
Yes.
That's amazing. But in the second half, it was like the siege of the Alamo.
And, you expect, really, yes.
Kevin Keegan was, you know, one of my heroes at the time, and he scored an equaliser. And, you know, they were bombarding us the whole of the second half. We were just getting behind the ball.
Mm.
And then in the last minute, someone knocked a long ball, hopeful punt forward, and I'm chasing it, and Ray Clements came out to collect it, and Emily News is running back, and they both wavered on who was going to get the ball. And I just kept running, and I just stuck a toe out, and the ball sailed over Ray Clements, and it dropped onto the top of the crossbar, bounced again on the crossbar, and dropped down, and Emily News got back and cleared it away.
Oh,
and that could have been probably one of the FA Cup shocks of all time, a bit like Hereford and Newcastle.
Absolutely. 3-2 win at Liverpool.
It was a fantastic experience in front of 30-odd thousand fans, and unfortunately we lost the replay 2-0, which was played on a Tuesday afternoon. And my great friend Terry Curran, who I know has been on your show,
he was
playing as well. And it was played at 2 o'clock because it was the miners' strike. And
yes,
so there was no, you know, there were all these power shortages and power outages on a regular basis.
Oh, I remember that. Oh dear.
Well, 20-odd thousand in Bellevue at Doncaster, but you know, when you're playing the top side, you only get one chance.
You do.
Usually, anyway, and you've got to take it. But fantastic experience.
Oh, absolutely. And you made a very poignant statement there, actually, Peter, as well, that the Liverpool fans gave you a standing ovation as you were leaving the pitch for after the first half. In fact, I think Liverpool fans used to always do that back in the day. I'm not quite sure it's the same now, but they often, you know, recognised quality, didn't they? In terms of a player or team. And that's an amazing thing to do, isn't it? Incredible.
Yeah, well, I think they Liverpool fans appreciate teams that are trying and giving their
exactly.
all. And, Liverpool were the best team in the country at the time.
And you were bottom of the fourth division. So, yeah, absolutely incredible.
So, yeah, it was a wonderful experience. And it probably gave me the confidence then. And I then, because shortly after that, I mean, the manager got sacked from me, Maurice Setter, who I didn't really get well with. And he was replaced by Stan Anderson, who'd been manager at Middlesbrough and played for all the top northeast sides. And that sort of gave me the confidence in myself. And from then, I was playing up front all the time and, you know, became a 20-odd goal a season man for the next four seasons. So it's a great base to build on.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it, that, a simple change, like a manager change, how it can be good luck for you or bad luck. You know, it changes the environment, doesn't it? The dynamics can change instantly. Whereas you were probably under Laurie McMenemy, one of his favoured, youngsters to go play, and he would have played you more often, wouldn't he? There's no doubt about that.
Definitely. I think, some players don't need, managers to give them the confidence. They go out there sort of, I've heard Graham Souness say on Sky, I didn't need the manager to like me or anything like that. I just went out and did that. But we're not all the same.
No.
And sometimes you need an arm around you and a bit of encouragement and to give you confidence. And Stan Anderson coming in for me was a brilliant thing, because he just gave, he used to say to the team, you know, every time you get 30, 40 yards from goal, look to play in Peter, because he'll score for you.
Brilliant.
And, you know, from there, and it was true. And I ended up scoring, you know, 25, 27, you know, goals a season. And it made a big difference to me. I finally believed in myself, shall I say.
Absolutely. And of course, you were also starting to attract attention from the higher divisions for several years, including spending time on trial at Bobby Robson's Ipswich Town before signing for Leyton Orient in the summer of 1977. So tell us more about your experience with Bobby Robson. What a great man he was, wasn't he? And your trial at Ipswich Town. Then, of course, your decision to sign for Leyton Orient.
Well, yeah, it was a brilliant experience, but it ended up being a very sad occasion in a sense. But it was the end of the coming up to the end of the 76-77 season. My contract, I'd refused to sign a new contract because I wanted to play higher level football. Mm. And the chief scout at Ipswich had been watching me, and they wanted me to go on a trial for 3 or 4 weeks to the end of the season. And the first team had more or less finished. I think they finished third in the old first division. And they'd gone off for a week or two to the Middle East to play a couple of exhibition games. So I played a reserve game, funnily enough, against one Cardiff City, who I later played for. And then when the first team came back, I played in a couple of testimonial games. I think one was at Cambridge or Chelmsford or somewhere like that. And I scored a couple of goals. And Bobby Robson called me in on the Friday, the last night, before I was going to leave to drive back to Doncaster, and said that I'd done very well, and he wanted to know how much he thought Doncaster would want for me. Said to him, well, in the paper they're saying they want 70,000, but in reality I think they'll accept 50. And he said, I was thinking more of 25. And I said, well, I don't think they'll accept that. He said, well, leave it with me. I'll see what I can do. He said, I can't even promise you a game in the reserves. So I can't up it very much. He said, I've got Weimar, Mariner and Woods in the first team. I've got Brazil, Alan Brazil, Eric Gates.
Side that was.
Yeah. He said, I've got those two, Keith Burchin.
Yes.
And David Geddes, who's on loan at Luton, I think it was, or Aston Villa. So he said, I can't even promise you a game in my reserve, son. He said, and these lads are 21 and you're 24, 25. And to which he said, but leave it with me. I'll see what I can do with, and I'll speak to Stan Anderson. Apparently, he offered 28,000, but Doncaster wouldn't come down, and then I got the offer a few weeks later to go to Leyton Orient, and then I was a bit reluctant to. I didn't want to move down to London. I was on the list, on the transfer list. It was common knowledge because my contract was up. And I said, I don't mind where I go, as long as it's not London. I don't know why, because now I live down here, I love it. But
yes, strange, isn't it?
At the time, I didn't really, it was a big, big jungle down here, and I thought, I don't know if I could settle. And so I ended up having three visits to come down and talk terms, and we kept negotiating on the contract, and I kept saying, no, I don't want 3 years. I might not settle. I'll be homesick. I want more money than what you're offering me. I don't know if I can afford to live down here. You know, all the usual practical things you have to consider.
Definitely.
And On the third visit, they agreed to everything I'd asked for. And they said, look, we'll give you everything you've asked for. Will you sign? We'll really look after you here. And I said, okay, I'll sign. And we shook hands with George Petchy, who was the manager, and Brian Winston, who was the chairman. And I went back on the train to Doncaster. And when I got back, I got a phone call from Stan Anderson. And he said, oh, how did it go? I said, yeah, well, he said, have you signed? I said, well, I haven't signed yet, but I'm going to. I've shaken hands with the chairman on that. And he said, only we've had another offer that's come in, and it's matched Leighton Orient's offer. And I said, well, who is it? He said, well, I'm not going to tell you because you've already agreed to sign. I said, look, I've shaken hands on it. I had this old-fashioned, yes. I suppose, morality that, if you shake hands and agree as a gentleman's agreement.
Absolutely.
And he said, oh, yeah, we've had an offer from Keith Birkinshaw at Tottenham. they've matched what Oriental paying. And I said, well, I was gutted, but I said, well, I've shaken hands. I can't go back on my word. And so I signed for Leighton Orient, and that was it.
A touch of deja vu there, isn't there, Peter? Really, it was Leeds United just after you signed for Doncaster. You've made an agreement, gentleman's agreement, shaking hands for Leighton Orient. And of course, then Tottenham Hotspur come along. I mean, what a story. It's great, isn't it?
I think it was a different time back in, and a different time, in the 70s and to now. And also, there were no agents. I had no one really to advise me. My dad was a lovely man, but he wasn't into high level contract negotiations or anything, and I was basically on my own and making these decisions. And I just felt that I couldn't go back on my word, I sometimes think what would have been, because to play with players like Glenn Hoddle, and who was one of my favourite players of all time.
Of course, yeah.
The quality of the balls that you get and the service you get from these, and especially as we know, Tottenham were then one of the great attacking sides of that era.
Absolutely, they were. Yes.
I signed for Leighton Orient, and as it happens, it turned out to be a very successful move.
Certainly did. I mean, your abilities as a football player, Peter, were respected and feared, actually, throughout the Championship and the lower divisions of the English Football League for over a decade. And it is said by many you should have played in the Premiership, and you almost did with, Leeds United, of course, and Tottenham Hotspur, or First Division it was back then today, of course. But you never got your lucky break, ultimately, although those breaks could have been there, but for reasons we've just discussed, and never offered the chance. You certainly had the ability, Peter. So what is your feeling here? You just sort of touched on it. Obviously, you would have liked to play in the highest domestic level, wouldn't you? And missed out on both Leeds United and Tottenham through reasons.
Yeah, well,
look, contracts.
In essence, when you look at things in a sort of a cold light of day, some of it was timing. As I mentioned earlier, Russell, you need to get the moves at the right time.
You do.
When you're younger. And when you're being very successful at a football club, they don't want to get rid of you. I was, not only was I, scoring goals regularly, but I was a very good professional. I rarely got injured.
Yes.
I'd rarely miss training. If I had a flu, I'd still go in and train, and when you're a good professional, managers don't want to sell you.
No.
And they priced me out of the transfer market on many occasions. When I signed for Leighton Orient and I was doing very well, we played Norwich City in the FA Cup, third round. We drew 1-1 at home and I scored the goal. We played Norwich City in the replay away and I scored and we beat Norwich. Straight after the game, I was told that John Bond, who was the manager, offered £140,000 cash for me.
Wow.
And Orient asked for $250,000. That was the price that they were suggesting. And obviously, you know, Norwich weren't going to do that. They ended up signing, the one of the brothers, the black lad, coloured lad.
Yes. It's escaped me as well now.
Scored the goal of the season.
Yeah, against Liverpool, wasn't it, as well?
Yeah.
That was against Liverpool at Norwich City, Carrow Road, wasn't it?
Fantastic. Yeah, well, he came through and so that never followed on, you know. And I also was tapped up by Terry Venables. No, it was illegal as such, but one day I was driving into pre-season at the end of that first season I was there, and he was in his car next to mine at the traffic lights, and he told me to pull over and asked me if I knew that he'd made an offer for me. And I said, no, I don't hear anything like that. They never tell me anything. It's always in the paper that there's someone, you know, there's someone looking at you or interested in signing you, but they never seemed to materialize. Anyway, he said, I've offered a player plus £110,000 for you, but Jimmy Bloomfield's turned it down and they want £250,000 for you cash, or they'll accept £100,000 and Vince Hilaire. And Vince Hilaire was, you know, was going to be the next Laurie Cunningham and the next, you know, the next top player. So, you know, again, the transfers never materialized because of the cost involved.
Yeah, and you know, pricing it up so they can't sell you. So that's a way of keeping you at the club, isn't it, really? Because they want you there. They want you at Orient to play football. And it was Fashanu, wasn't it, that scored that cracking
goal?
That's
the one, yeah, Justin Fashanu.
Justin Fashanu. Yeah. And cracking goal he scored against Liverpool, goal of the season. I do remember that. Brilliant. So again, another opportunity. These opportunities do come along, and it was a different day going back in the time of football then. Tapping up did happen. We know that all the time. But you were ever present in your first year at Orient in 1977-78 and finished as the club's top scorer of 21 goals. I think it was 21 goals. I'm sure you're correct if I'm wrong, Peter. As well as scoring 7 times in the FA Cup. As Orient went on to reach the FA Cup semi-finals, beating Chelsea and Middlesbrough along the way. I mean, that's some start to your footballing career at Orient, really, isn't it, Peter? 21 goals, first season, you know, iconic Peter Kitchen at Orient. Fantastic.
Yeah, in total, it was 29 because I scored a League Cup goal as well.
Okay.
You know, they don't always seem to count the Cup goals, but scored 21 league goals in 42 games. And I mean, I was so desperately trying to prove that I could play at the highest level. And, you know, we were playing against top sides like Tottenham, who'd been relegated the season before.
Yes.
And Orient weren't renowned as a side that scored a lot of goals. You know, I think even that season we were the second lowest goal scorers in the league. So, you know, scoring goals in a team that's struggling and not doing that well is a lot more difficult than when you're playing in a side that's winning games. But so it was, you know, it was a phenomenal game and a phenomenal season. And
definitely.
Yeah, I mean, but it was a great club to play for in the sense that there were a really good set of lads. There were no egos, you know. It was like a Cinderella club in a sense, like and everyone's second club. You know, if you're a Spurs fan, you can't support Arsenal or West Ham or Chelsea.
Yes.
You know, so, but it was a wonderful friendly club, and it helped, and that helped me to settle down south to the point that I said after 3 or 4 months, I never wanted to move back up north.
Oh, brilliant.
But, so, you know, when we played in the FA Cup, you know, we weren't doing so well in the league. We were in the bottom half of the league. But in the FA Cup, there was a different mindset, you know. Mm-hmm. Jimmy Bloomfield was the manager. And I mean, I didn't, you know, I'm not going to talk ill of Jimmy because he was the sort of manager that he liked experienced players and he didn't do a lot of coaching. Whereas you get some coaches, some managers that want to improve players and young players and bring them through.
Yes.
But Jimmy was also ill. He was suffering from bowel cancer.
Oh, and so sad.
Very, very sad. I mean, he died in 1983.
Oh, sad.
And we only found out as the season went on just how bad his illness was.
Mm.
But he missed quite a few games. And the assistant, Peter Angel, who'd been was a lovely man, and he'd been at QPR for most of his career. Was a real he encouraged you. He was very positive and always encouraged you to go forward and to try and attack. And we were playing. We'd drawn with Chelsea at home, 0-0, and
right.
And the wall collapsed, and there were no serious injuries.
I was at the game actually, Peter. To be honest, at Brisbane Road.
All right, well, I think I scored a goal that was disallowed, and then late on in the game, John Jackson, the goalkeeper, he pulled off a phenomenal save, and it ended 0-0. And no one expected us to win the replay at Chelsea. And in the first half, I was getting kicked to death by Chopper Harris.
You'd expect that against Chopper.
Yeah. He's just following me around, and every time the ball came to me, he would come through the back of me. And
I was at the game; I remember it well.
And then Bill Roffey, our fullback, scored an on goal just before half time, and we went in at half time, and I think we were all a bit down. And Peter just said, "Look, lads, go out there and give it your all, have a go. There's no point worrying about it. You can do it." And it was like a different team came out, If it had been around as much, you'd have think that we'd all been snorting cocaine, because the second half, we were just phenomenal. We hadn't been, by the way. And, I scored a couple of really good goals, and it was almost platformed the team. Suddenly, clubs were starting to look at our players.
Yes.
They've got some really good players, this team. People like Glenn Roeder and Phil Hoadley, who recently died,
Yes.
And they both went on from there and played in the first division. Tony Grealish, who later went to Brighton and played in the cup final and had a number of good clubs. So all of a sudden, from having this struggling team, people started to take note of the players, and it was really, it was a great atmosphere at the club.
I mean, that showed in the second half at Stamford Bridge, because I was a very young Chelsea supporter at the time. So I, like most Chelsea fans back on that day, were thinking, well, we're going to get through this quarterfinals. Here we come. Of course, it didn't happen. But I have to say, you scored both of Orient's goals that day, didn't you? I seem to remember. One of which was a mesmerising run into the penalty box, I think gliding past some three or four Chelsea players before slotting the ball home past Peter Benetti, the late and great Peter Benetti, of course. I mean, that was some goal, Peter, and really akin to Ricky Villa's goal in the 1981 FA Cup final replay at Wembley. That was a tremendous goal you scored there, wasn't it? Fantastic.
Yeah, I think when you... as a goal scorer, I was always an instinctive goal scorer, Sometimes you can't explain what you do and why you did it at that particular time. And a ball was knocked out down the right-hand side towards the edge of the box. And I turned inside Chopper Harris. I think for once I got away from him.
Yes.
Then Mickey Droy came steaming in, 6'4". I dropped my shoulder and he went skating by. And I was ready to shoot. And then all of a sudden, I saw Ian Britton coming on the left-hand side out of the corner. So instead, I dummied to shoot, and he went steaming by as well. So it was really just dropping my shoulders, and they all bought the dummy.
Yes, and they certainly did.
Left me just with Peter Benetti to put it past. But yeah, I mean, it's a wonderful experience, and it's one of the, funny enough, having scored over 200 goals, it's one of the few that's actually been captured for posterity.
Oh, and a great goal to be captured too. And I can remember you literally turning after slopping past Peter Bonetti to go 2-1 up. I can remember you running up that middle of the field. You were like full of pure excitement, enthusiasm, and your arms were all over the place. All your the other players were steaming around you. I mean, what a great goal and a great, exciting, way to score. And of course, to celebrate at the same time. It's fantastic, Peter. I mean, I was a Chelsea fan. I was depressed at the time, but, you know, you've got to say that was an absolutely fantastic goal. And a great performance by Orient.
I think in those days, players were much more reserved in their celebrations.
Yes.
And, you know, I mean, Alan Shearer just, you know, in the 80s, Alan Shearer just used to put one arm up. And
he did. But you weren't reserved, were you, on that goal?
The same, you know.
Yes.
I mean, I sort of tended to copy those and not, you know, copy Alan Clark and not really show much.
Mm.
You know, emotion and just say, well, that's another goal, blah, you know, not being arrogant, but you just go, that's another goal. And
more than just a goal, that was just incredible.
You know, so I mean, when it went in, I think I just couldn't believe it myself. I think, you know, I had to close my mouth. If it had been warm, I'd have probably caught a few flies in there.
Yeah, it was a cold old evening, wasn't it, Stamford Bridge that night? It was quite chilly. But yeah, but that's fantastic. And Orient were through to the quarterfinals. I mean, it just beggars belief, doesn't it? And fantastic too, because you performed very well that year. Just a wonderful, wonderful cup run, wasn't it? I think you lost to Arsenal 3-0, was it, in the semi-finals?
Yeah.
What a great cup run.
Yeah, we drew, we played Middlesbrough, in the sixth round, and at Ayresome Park. And I don't think any of us really fancied, you know, a trip up there. And I know that the supporters that I've spoken to since were terrified because Middlesbrough had a terrible reputation in terms of fighting and beating up, you know, travelling fans. And I don't think any of us really looked forward to it. But when we just, I think everybody got behind the ball and we just tried to get a draw. And fortunately, you know, it worked. You know, they missed a couple of chances to have won the game. We hardly got out of our half, but we got the game back at Brisbane Road, and I scored a goal, I think, after about 6 minutes with an overhead kick from just out on the edge of the box.
Which, wow!
You know, it was another one of those instinctive goals that is, you know, you don't score very often. And Big Joe, who was my striking partner, Joe Mayo, he scored a second one. And then, you know, we were holding on in the second half because Middlesbrough were trying to get back and they got a goal back. But we held on and got through to the semi-finals for the first time in the club's history.
Brilliant cup run.
And I think we were all hoping we'd get West Brom because there was Ipswich, Arsenal, and West Brom, and we were all hoping we'd get West Brom because we thought we'd have the best chance against them getting something. But unfortunately, we drew Arsenal, and on the day, everybody thinks we froze, but I don't think we did. We went out there with the intent on just staying in the game as long as possible and hoping that we would grow into the game.
Yes.
Maybe, you know, I'd get a chance to nick a goal, or, you know, we'd get a free kick and somebody had head one in, or, you know, and, you know, we really were up for it, but we just couldn't, you know, we were under lots of pressure. And then Malcolm McDonald scored two goals that were deflections. Mm. They were going out. They wouldn't have even hit the target, but they bounced off two of our defenders into the goal. And when you're 2-0 down against a club like Arsenal, you know, you it's not easy to get back. You know, you're chasing, trying to climb a mountain, and it was just a bit too far for us to get back in it. But it was a wonderful experience, you know, what a fantastic season. You know, personally, I won goal of the season, player of the year, Daily Mirror Footballer of the Month, Evening Standard Footballer of the Month. You know, for me personally, it was a wonderful pinnacle, really, of my career.
Definitely. Absolutely right there, Peter. I mean, moving forward is quite a poignant thing to say. Moving forward a few years to 1999, You were voted by fans of both Doncaster Rovers and Leyton Orient as one of their greatest ever players. And in more recent polls conducted by BBC Football Focus, 442 magazine, and other popular fanzines, you were voted as one of the best players at both clubs, with some of those polls taking more than 20 years after you played for them. It's incredible, isn't it? And even today, you're still considered a cult hero amongst both sets of fans. I mean, that in itself, Peter, tells a great footballing story, doesn't it? I mean, how does this make you feel? I mean, you must be honoured, I'm sure.
Oh, definitely. I mean, In any job, you want to be appreciated.
Yes, you do.
And to have had so much success at two of the clubs I played for, and to be so well thought of, is wonderful, really. I mean, you know, I've been voted into the Hall of Fame at both of those clubs.
Well, rightly so too.
You know, and at Doncaster, they've got a big picture of me behind the goal. And they've named one of their bars after me. And at Orient, they've named one of the tower blocks after me and a bar in the ground. So, you know, you can think, well, yeah, maybe if I'd have gone to Tottenham, I think I would have done well. But but I probably might not have had the accolades that I did have by playing, you know, at Orient and Doncaster and you know, at the end of the day, all we have is memories, and so you can
exactly.
Look back and feel very happy with your contribution, you know, in that respect.
Yeah, and those memories, those moments, no one can take them away, can they, really? And you certainly had a very rich life in football at those two clubs. There's no doubt about that whatsoever. And I saw, I think, one of your social media Facebook posts just recently, where you were at Doncaster Rovers for an end-of-the-season match, or it might have even been the playoff semi-final. I can't remember. And you are definitely epitomised around the ground and in complete glory. There was a large picture of you, as you say, behind one of the goals. I mean, that's fantastic. That's some accolade, Peter, isn't it, really, for a club to look at you and bring that into the ground like that from all those years ago. That's incredible, really. It's an incredible journey.
Yeah, I think, you know, to when you think it's sort of 40-odd years since I played for both clubs.
Yeah, exactly.
It makes you feel very proud, yeah, definitely. I went up to Doncaster only last week to see the second leg of the playoff final, and
yes,
you know, I was a guest of the former chairman, and you know, we were talking, funnily enough, and he was saying, because he was chairman for 15 years and John Ryan, and he took the club, bought the club when they got relegated from the Football League, and he took them all the way back up the leagues to the Championship in his 15-year tenure.
Yes.
And, you know, he said, you know, you and Alex Jeffrey are my heroes.
Wow. And that must have been the Facebook post, social media post I saw of you being at Doncaster Rovers that I mentioned earlier on. And that's fantastic, isn't it, to be invited back by the then chairman?
Fans still come up to you and say, oh, you were my hero, and can I have a photo? And
wonderful.
And it's, you know, you can't really, you must enjoy that sort of, anybody would enjoy that sort of adulation, really.
Oh, I quite agree.
And I mean, I don't lose sight of, you know, where you come from and that, and it's just very nice to have been recognised in that way.
Quite right, too. And long may you continue to be recognised, too. I'm sure you'll get many invites back. Do you ever go back to Orient at all, Peter? Do they invite you back?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I go to quite a few games. I do an online match preview.
Oh, brilliant.
I've been doing for about 6 or 7 years now, and a match report. But it's not like a journalist report saying, you know, so-and-so scored this in this minute. And I tend to focus on the sort of intangible things about a game, you know, the psychological or what systems they were playing, whether or not the players agree with the manager's tactics, you know, the things that are not necessarily so readily obvious when you when you're watching a game. You know.
No, I quite agree. You have to invite me along. I'll come down and watch a game with you, Orin. That'd be a fantastic thing to do.
A lot of managers, you know, a lot of fans will say, you know, after a game, they'll say, "Oh, the players weren't trying. The players weren't, you know, end of season's here already. They're not bothered." And I've never really known a professional footballer not to try and not to give his all. And when that's happening, I always say to them, I don't agree with that. I think what you'll find is they probably don't believe in the way the manager's playing or the tactics is imposing on them and asking them to play. And I think, you know, a lot of footballers know a lot more about the game without realizing it.
Yes.
You instinctively know when you're in a team whether you're playing the right way or not. You know, I can remember an incident when I was at Fulham, and I'd signed for Fulham, and we were playing. I think it was Cambridge away, and it was a big mistake going to Fulham because the manager and the vibe at the club wasn't the same as at Orient, and the manager I didn't really like at all. He you know, in my opinion, I say this, he was a bully.
Yes.
And he'd been put into a job that he wasn't good enough to do. It's my opinion that, you know, so
we're all entitled to our opinions,
I don't mind saying that, but you know, we were playing Cambridge United in this game. We'd only been there 3 weeks, and I hadn't really settled into the team, and we got absolutely hammered in the first half against Cambridge. And it was 3-0 at half time. And as the players came in, they're all a bit, you know, heads down and that, you know, because we never could get close to Cambridge. They were knocking long balls in and pressurizing us. And the manager went round every single player and he verbally abused each one with his finger in their face.
Oh.
And swearing at them and threatening them and every single player in the team. And, you know, came to me and he said, "And you swearing at me, you think you've arrived. Well, you know, you haven't. You'll be out of the team if you don't get your finger up." And we went out the second half and we ended up losing 4-0. They scored one. And after that, I thought, you know, because I used to be a deep thinker about football.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And I thought, well, that is not the way to lift players and manage players.
You Definitely know, not.
Everybody needs occasionally a kick up the backside, but it's how you do it.
Of course it is.
And now if I was faced with that situation, I would have stood up to him and, you know, and said, "You're talking a lot of crap. Have you thought it might be the way you're playing the team and how you've picked the team and set it up?"
Yeah. Bad tactics.
Yeah. And that's the thing about football, is that during the era that we played, managers weren't as open-minded and as modern thinking as a lot of them are now. You know, with the influx of foreign coaches and that, you can, you know, there's a lot of there's a lot more insight and that, you know, in football and how you play. But you know, that's just another rich experiences, really.
Of course it is. And of course they say that you struggle to find form at Fulham, which is probably not the case. You struggle to work with the tactics of the manager and to deal with the manager. And of course, your second year at Fulham, you had suffered with a series of injuries, which saw you miss most of the season anyway. And Fulham were eventually relegated and you moved to Cardiff City.
Yeah, I mean, the second season there, I was only injured at the start of the season.
Oh, okay.
And I was out for about 3 or 4 weeks. And during that time, Gordon Davis, who went on to become Fulham's record goal scorer, came into the team and did very well. And, you know, good luck to Gordon. You know,
he's a good player, wasn't he?
He's a good player and that. But the team was still struggling. got relegated at the end of that season. And I played the whole season in the reserves when I got fit. And I think I scored about 34 or 35 goals. And he wouldn't even pick me on the bench. Oh. You know, my relationship with the manager had broken down to such an extent.
That,
you know, he just basically wrote me out.
Yeah, it's terrible.
To this day, we never actually spoke. He never actually called me in his office and explained why or anything.
A bad manager, bad coach, bad manager. Clearly not suitable for.
I went to Cardiff to continue my career. I thought Cardiff would be. Cardiff is probably the biggest of all the clubs I played for. Mm. You know, potentially they would. Although Fulham are in the Premier League now, I mean Cardiff were in the Premier League about 10 years ago.
They were indeed.
They could get easily 35,000-40,000. You know,
a big club.
Yeah, big club and that. But off the field, there was a lot of. There was a lot of wrangling in the boardroom, and financially, there was a lot of problems in football at the time.
Yes, no, absolutely.
I enjoyed my first season. I ended up top scorer with 19 goals. But the second season, I think we had a turnover of about 5 or 6 managers. So I sort of asked to cancel my 3-year contract, and I left at the end of that season. And Cardiff got relegated.
They did indeed that year. They did indeed. I mean, you did also score 5 times in a 6-0 win over Cardiff Corinthians in the Welsh Cup, I've read about as well. So you did end up with 19 goals in all competitions as Cardiff City and that season. Just avoided relegation too. So your renowned goal-scoring prowess, you could say, had returned at Cardiff City, Peter. It got you back in the game.
I never doubted that I couldn't score goals, and even in sides that weren't playing particularly well,
yes,
you instinctively know that what positions to take up, and it's certainly a lot easier when you're playing with good players. That you know, I mean, I don't know if you saw the game the other night with Man City at Tottenham, you know, and you see Erling Haaland. I mean, he hardly had a touch, and his first goal was from about 3 yards, and all he had to do was side foot it in because of the players around him just made the space and made, you know, the passes were superb.
And he was clearly unmarked, wasn't he, in that 6-yard box? Yeah. And an easy tackle.
Play with players like that,
yeah,
you know, makes such a difference.
Huge difference. Incredible, really. You know, that's really quite an incredible thing to do. It reminds me, actually, of Alan Clark of Leeds. He was that goal sniffer type, wasn't he? But he had great players around him at Leeds too. So it is a team effort, isn't it, that makes the player really who scores the goals.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, the service that you get is you know, vitally important. You know, you need to have certain types of players. You need to have width and wide players and that take people on, you know.
Exactly.
You've got to have a lot of running off the ball. There are so many things that make you score, you know, that create chances to score goals. I used to find that managers would always be saying to me what I wasn't doing.
Yes.
Not what I was doing. You know, whether it's that negativity, that mindset, instead of, you know, where some of the managers I had would be critical all the time and saying, you know, yeah, you scored 2, but you should have been doing this and you should have been doing that, you know. And
that's not good tactics either, is it? That's bad management, really.
Well, I think management is about getting the best out of the players you've got.
Of course.
Because you can't, you know, not every team can go out and buy 10 Ronaldos or, you know, Messis, and you have to work with what you have.
Exactly. And get the best out of them. So being negative really is quite a bad thing, isn't it? You've got to lift them up as well a bit, really. You know, it's all right saying, you know, improve your game by doing this and that. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, oh, you had a great game, Peter, today. Well done. Great 2 goals. You want to hear that, don't you? You're ready
to do it. Well, yeah, definitely.
Crikey. And then after leaving Cardiff City, you had a short spell with Hong Kong side Happy Valley before returning to play once again for Leyton Orient in 1982-83. Well, you made another 49 league appearances in your second spell with the London club. So what was it like to return to Leyton Orient? The fans must have been delirious, surely. The great Peter Kitchen has returned.
Yeah, I think, I mean, Orient were in a dire position when I came back. And they were about, I think it was about 12 points adrift at the bottom of League One.
Oh, wow.
And I came back and I asked them to train because I lived in Epping at the time, so it was quite close. And well, I got my international clearance.
Mm.
And I was training with them, and Ken Knighton was the manager and asked me if I'd want to sign again. So, you know, I didn't really have as met that many options. So it was very suitable for me to re-sign. And I signed in December, and the week before, I played on this Friday night against Preston, and we were drawing 1-1, and there were about 5 minutes to go, and I got the ball got knocked through, and I managed to run onto it and round the keeper and slot it into the empty net, and we won the game 2-1. And I think there were only about 2,500 there.
Wow.
Which showed how bad the support was.
Yes.
But from then on, we won 6 on the trot and got out of the bottom 4 before I broke my toe and was out for about 6 or 7 games. But I came back for the last few and scored in our last game. We had to beat Sheffield United to stay up, and we did, and stayed in the league. So it was almost like another rescue act in sense of, you know, stopping them from getting relegated. Because when I was at Orient in my first spell, the last game of the season, we had to beat Cardiff City to stay in the Championship. And I scored the goal and we beat them 1-0. So, you know, I kept Orient in the Championship, and I also kept them in League One in both spells. So
yes.
I'm sure that's part of why I was so popular at the club.
Oh, I'm sure it's not just those seasons or those games. It's probably the whole of the time, the whole tenure at Orient, you know, including that FA Cup run to the semi-finals. You are literally an icon. So that's just great, isn't it? And then, like most professional footballers at the end of their playing career, which yours was about to become, you then went to play major indoor soccer league football with Las Vegas Americans. I mean, how was your time in the USA, Peter? A lot of players go, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, it was a new adventure, really. I'd had a few offers to stay in England. Harry Redknapp asked me if I wanted to go to Bournemouth. But I thought that, you know, going to America was like a real opportunity. And I thought maybe I might get a coaching job and might decide to, you know, sometimes you get these opportunities. And it was a whole new adventure, really. And it was a fantastic experience. And I think I was fitter at 32 playing there than I've been all my career.
Wow.
Because, you know, that they had all the technology and that we have now. They already had it back in those days. I mean, the doctor who was in charge of the team, I think, was a guy called Keith Cleven, who was Muhammad Ali's doctor.
Wow.
Well, which gives you an idea of the level of competence that they
definitely
they had in terms of that. So it was a fantastic experience, and part of the contract was that every week 3 or 4 of us had to go down to this local park and coach some of the kids, you know, and they used to have these open day coaching schemes. And I never saw as many girls coming to play football, little girls come to play football as I did then. And so, you know, that's going back 40 years, and now you can see the growth of football. You know, it's almost like seeing it at its infancy and then seeing how it's developed now.
Well, ladies, football in America is huge, isn't it? I mean, they're you know, what's it, still world number one at football, the ladies in America? I mean, they're a top side, aren't they? That shows it, really. All that nurturing of, as you say, the young ladies starting to come along and play football all those years ago. Fantastic. That's good to see. I mean, even after your retirement from the professional game, you played for a number of other clubs, including a short comeback from Argate in 1991. And whilst playing for the Corinthian Casual Vets, I've got to say this, up to the age of 53, you scored an amazing 280 goals from 228 appearances. I mean, there seems to be no holding back a top goal scoring marksman, does there, Peter, really? 53. I mean, incredible.
Yeah, I mean, I love my time playing for the Corinthian Casuals because the ethos of the club. I mean, it's still an amateur side now. They're playing in the sort of Isthmian leagues or whatever, but
they are, yes.
Sort of the club they was to, I suppose, demonstrate that the gentlemanly way football used to be played and should be played, and we used to play a lot of the public schools around the country. And I always used to joke that every year the kids are the same age, but every year we're a year older. But it was a fantastic experience. And, you know, there were a few semi-pro players that had played, you know, in the sort of semi-pro leagues. And a couple of, every now and again, you'd have an ex player come as well. I mean, one week we had Alan Pardew playing for us. Another week, what was I thinking of? And we'd have Alex Stewart playing, a cricketer. And, you know, we had some guest appearances by some top sportsmen. And
wonderful.
It was just fantastic. And during that time, we also went on tour to Brazil, South Africa. We went to Moscow.
Wow, some international travel too.
Yeah, I mean, I just love those trips. You know, it's fantastic. We were treated, you know, like royalty, especially in Brazil, because the Corinthians in Brazil, now in Sao Paulo,
yes,
they were formed from the Corinthians of England.
Wow, what a great story!
In 1910, a team called the Corinthians used to be in a top amateur club in the country, and they went out to Brazil on a football tour, and they played against some Brazilians who then formed the Corinthians, who went on to become this team now that plays in the Brazilian first.
Yeah, they're a huge team in Brazil, aren't they, Corinthians? Yeah.
So, and fantastic. I mean, when we went there, we were guests of the club. So, you know, just fabulous experiences, and which were a real bonus as you get, you know, later on in your sort of career and your life.
I often say, you know, travel is the best form of investment, really. So you're getting at the back end of your career. That's fantastic. What wonderful countries to visit. And playing a game you love. I mean, you retired as a football player at the age of 33 and took up coaching on the youth development program at Wimbledon Football Club. I mean, how did you take to the coaching side of football?
Well,
very different, isn't it?
I was part time at Wimbledon. I had a good job outside of football in terms of I went into sports management initially. I went back to college and did a postgraduate business diploma, and I got a job as a leisure centre manager, and gradually progressed to being a contracts manager and then operations director for a leisure management side. But it allowed me as well to have time to coach as well. So I coached at Wimbledon for about 10 years when they were in the Premier League.
Yeah, wow.
Managed the under-13s, under-14s, under-15s. And, you know, I was there when they were
the crazy gang.
and it was a great club, I've got to say.
Oh,
you know,
yes.
It wasn't rigid. It wasn't too structured. it was full of almost mavericks, you know.
Yeah, Billy Jones, Dennis Wise. Oh, the list is endless.
Yeah, good. I loved coaching the kids, you know. I think because I never used to, you know, personally, I was a bit soft, too soft, which is why I probably wouldn't have made a good football manager. But I used to look at some of the lads, and especially the black kids, because some of them, I used to talk to them, and I find out that they, you know, their dad wasn't at home, and
sad.
And they used to find out about their family life, and so I used to always try and take that into consideration, and it helped motivate a lot of them that they could come and talk to someone, you know, that you know, and I really enjoyed it. And some of the lads, I mean, Joby McEnough, who played at Orient and is now on Sky, he was one of the lads I brought through in those three years. And, you know, it was just a wonderful experience. They were great kids, and Wimbledon had a great youth setup. So, really.
Fantastic to hear. Fantastic to hear.
Whenever I had any other time, I was playing charity games for the TV commentators 11 and playing for the Corinthian Casuals. So, I tried to keep myself as fit as possible.
Of course. And quite rightly so too. And then in your book, The Gold Gourmet, the title of the show, of course, author Nielsen Hoffman, I think I pronounced his name right, captures the life and times of your illustrious footballing career, Peter, which is about one of the most prolific goal scorers outside of the Premier League. The book features tributes and contributions from TV commentators, former managers, fans and friends, and former teammates, with over 100 photographs. There's also a full statistical record of one of the greatest players ever to pull on a Doncaster Rovers and Leyton Orient shirt. Yes, you, Peter. Oh, it's a great book, isn't it? So apart from Doncaster Rovers and Leyton Orient Football Club shops, where else can supporters and interested individuals purchase the Gold Gourmet book? Let's give it a bit of a push.
Yeah, it's available on Amazon.
Yep.
When we did the first launch, it was with a Derwent Press, I think it was, when Neil and I did the first book. But Derwent Press, I think they sold up and then disappeared a few years back. And so I did a reprint because I was getting a lot of people asking me for that. Mm. So a reprint and that on myself. So it was limited to the Doncaster and Orient club shops. And as I say, Amazon. So it's still available on Amazon if anyone would like to buy a copy.
Well, I'd recommend going out to buy it. I'm sure it's a fabulous book and from a fantastic football player. So definitely worth a purchase, I would say. What other interests do you have outside of football, Peter? We're sort of coming to the end of the show now. Crikey.
I try and keep myself as fit as possible. I can't jog anymore because I played in a charity match about 7 years ago and tore my knee meniscus. And I'd never had a serious injury before. So I had an operation. It didn't work. So I now cycle three or four times a week to try and keep myself fit. But my main passion, shall I say, is traveling.
Yes.
And I try to get away and do things as often as possible. And I'm also very, very interested in the Great War.
Wow.
It became popular in football for the football authorities to start sort of building memorials and that in, I think, 2010. Well, I've been visiting the Somme battlefields since 1980.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So
it's incredible.
You know, and I sort of got a library of books on the Great War. I find it a fascinating thing. It was such a pivotal in society at the time. And I'm patron of the Old Somme Memorial Fund, which is a fund that I set up with Steve Jenkins, who's the vice chairman of the Supporters Club.
Yes.
Steve was researching a story of Clapton Orient's footballers in the Great War, and he knew that I go to the Somme and the Ypres and, you know, the different battlefields. Mm. And so we got chatting, and he said, would I help him with his book? So I wrote the foreword and helped him promote and launch it. And then him and I set up this Somme fund in 2009, and the intention of building a permanent memorial to the Clapton Orient footballers of 1914.
What a cracking idea.
Who were the first professional English footballers to enlist into the army.
Mm.
And they 11 players enlisted, and three were killed in the Battle of the Somme. And I because of my many trips to France, I knew the mayor of Fleurs and some other people in the various towns. And we managed to get them to agree to give us a plot of land in their village. And we raised about 20 grand to have the memorial built, which we unveiled in 2011. And in 2021, we unveiled a similar memorial at the National Arboretum in Staffordshire.
Wonderful.
To the Orient footballers. So I've been sort of quite passionate about that. And we're still obviously promoting the story and doing as much as we can to help promote the footballers in the Great War, really.
Right, rightly so too. My grandfather was in the Battle of the Somme, and he did get mustard gassed, actually. But somebody, one of his comrades, pulled him out of a rabbit hole, and he survived. But of course, he was in Portsmouth Hospital for about 6 months. I think he was temporarily blind for that time, but he survived. He wasn't an accountant, became a part-time fireman in Aldershot, and lived about 88 years of age. So, there's testament to the great man. Fantastic. Yeah. Amazing, isn't it? So I wouldn't be sitting here now if it wasn't he'd have perished. So, that's a good thing, really. But, yeah, that's an amazing thing to do. It's a great passion, Peter, isn't it? The Great War.
I find it really is good. And it's great to actually bring it to younger people as well, to know what happened in these.
Exactly.
Seasons. I mean, at Orient, we've this coming up this July, because of our involvement with the story, we've managed to get Leighton Orient to agree to play a friendly with Heart of Midlothian in July.
Mm.
Because Heart of Midlothian and a number of other Scottish clubs, they were the first Scottish footballers to enlist in 1914.
Oh, amazing.
And so we've managed to get the two clubs to agree to play a pre-season friendly in July.
Brilliant.
And hopefully, that should be quite a high-profile game.
Mm.
And we've also got a youth tournament in France at the end of August for the Orient youth team are playing over there against Lingfield from Ireland and from a couple of teams in France. So, we're trying to bring the story as much as we can into the public eye. And, we've been very successful in that. And I'm very pleased with the work we've done.
Yeah, credit to you. Absolute credit to you, Peter, for that. That's fantastic. You have to let me know the date of that match against Hearts at Brisbane Road, because I am away, actually.
It's up in Edinburgh. It's up in at Heart of Midlothian's ground.
Oh, wonderful.
It's also their 150th anniversary. So they wanted to utilise that game part of their celebrations.
Are you going?
I will be, yes, I'll be there.
Brilliant. So let me know when it is, because I know I'm away for the first 2 weeks in July, but actually, I'm back for the second 2 weeks, and I'd like to come up and watch.
It should be a fantastic occasion.
Great stuff. Let me know the date. Anyway, we are literally an hour and 15 minutes, in fact, over. I mean, it's incredible. I mean, what a great chat we've had here. It's been amazing. It's truly.
It's funny because I said to my partner, Catherine, before, she said, how long will you be? I said, well, I'm not like Terry Curran, I said, he can talk for England. And I noticed you interviewed him last month, and he was on for about an hour and a half.
There he was. Brilliant.
And I said, no, I'll be finished in about an hour. So.
Well, you're about an hour and 20 now.
Nobody can talk as much as TC.
He certainly can talk. What a lovely fella he is, too. A great man, too.
He is a wonderful chap.
Top bloke, yeah. Top footballer, top man. Brilliant guy. So, could you mind staying on whilst I wrap up, Peter? We'll have a quick chat afterwards, particularly about Heart of Midlothian and Orient as well. That's a fantastic match.
Pleasure.
Brilliant, thank you. As always, on the World of Lord Russell podcast talk show, we could talk forever, Peter, about your life, an amazing life in professional football. It's been a huge pleasure as always. And as always, the pleasure is all mine. And of course, the show's audience when this podcast is released on the World of Lord Russell podcast talk show and the Lord Russell Baker YouTube channel. Thank you, Peter. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Peter Kitchen a huge round of applause. Fantastic story. Great show. It really is.
Thank you, Russell. Really enjoyed talking to you.
Oh, likewise. The next episode on the World of Lord Russell podcast talk show is Olympic Flame from Olympia, where my special guest will be Lance Haggith, who is the founder of the Sports Trader charity in the UK and winner of the 2010 BBC Sports Personality of the Year Unsung Hero Award. Oh, incredible. Lance Haggith was a Royal Navy reservist for 6 years and a National League basketball player and coach. Lance Haggith was appointed Officer of the Order of the British Empire, OBE, in the 2022 Birthday Honours for charitable and voluntary services to vulnerable people, particularly during COVID-19. So another exciting show to look forward to on the World of Lord Russell podcast talk show, available, of course, on all podcast media platforms and the Lord Russell Baker YouTube TV channel. And of course, I'm looking forward to seeing you all on the inside. So until then, it's au revoir from him and au revoir from me.